treatment and don't see any actual change in results. If your weakness is that you aren't able to communicate coherently or empathize with what other people are expressing, then being encouraged to approach 500 women on the street is going to be an absolute disaster. If you are broke, live with your parents, have no job, then being encouraged to spend all your time and money out in nightclubs is only going to get you a bunch of meaningless sex with mediocre drunk girls who have no better options. If you're scared to death of saying anything to a woman you find attractive, then the best conversation tricks, teasing and flirting lines, or even openers are not going to help you. But as I said earlier, the three fundamentals are interdependent. They feed off of one another. So if your biggest problem is an inability to communicate well, then approaching 500 women won't directly benefit you, but the fact that you're talking to 500 new people will indirectly help your issue. In the same way, being able to communicate effectively will help guys with extreme levels of anxiety in their development, because the few times they do work up the nerve to make a move on a woman, they'll usually do it in a very calibrated and smooth way. It's important to cater the advice that you implement to your specific issues. Hopefully reading this chapter, you have at least a vague idea of where your weaknesses are. The rest of this book is dedicated to breaking down each one of the fundamentals individually and giving clear how-to guides for improving them. Identifying and focusing on the fundamentals you need to work on most will be the quickest route to improving your love life and sex life. Most of you will have one or two main weaknesses and probably one natural strength, but some of you will be weak in all of them. I guarantee you, if you're reading this, you're not strong in all of them. If you think you are and are still reading this far, then you're deluding yourself and need to reread chapter 4 on finding your own truth and being honest with yourself. In my experience, 90% of men fall into one of two categories, anxious or socially disconnected. Anxious guys tend to have the third fundamental down very well. They're good at expressing themselves and are very aware of social norms and what others are thinking and feeling. In fact, in a lot of cases, anxious guys are too aware of what other people are thinking and feeling, and therefore have a lot of social anxiety. They're afraid to approach. They get nervous pushing things forward. They're scared to ask girls out on dates. Generally, though, once these guys do meet a girl, they do fine. They can converse with her all night, and if she happens to be attracted to him, he's not such a mess. But it's the actual being proactive and making a move that scares him to death. These guys usually spend most of their time focusing on overcoming fear and little time on expression. Socially disconnected guys are the opposite. These are men who have always been a little bit oblivious to what others think and feel around them. Usually they're guys who have always kind of kept to themselves or grew up more interested in their studies or some subject than the people around them. Interestingly, men who are socially disconnected almost never have much fear or anxiety when it comes to approaching, pursuing, or escalating. In fact, it's because they're so oblivious to social cues and what others are thinking and feeling that makes them so fearless. The struggle for men in this category is going to be the third fundamental, learning how to express themselves and understand how people think and feel around them. These men tend to have little hesitance or little fear of action, but they tend to just do the wrong actions at the wrong times over and over and over again and rarely understand why. The first fundamental, lifestyle, tends to be all over the map and is always a work in progress for everyone. The better your lifestyle, the easier everything else will become. But the second and third fundamentals are intimately connected to one another. Anxious guys are anxious because they're too socially attuned to others. And social disconnectors are fearless because they're socially disconnected from others. The idea is to become socially connected and fearless at the same time and have an awesome and attractive lifestyle. The full package, the three fundamentals. But whichever type you are, read all three sections, and even reading about areas in which you're naturally strong will reinforce your positive habits, and you will probably pick up a few minor pointers on how to improve your strengths even further. Part three is about honest living, building an attractive and abundant lifestyle so that quality women who are most compatible with you naturally gravitate into your life. Part 4 is about honest action, overcoming your fears and anxieties so that you may act on your impulses and desires without hesitation or shame. Part 5 is about honest communication, training you to express yourself openly and effectively in a dynamic and interesting way that will keep women interested in you and help you make transition into becoming physical with them. Parts 3 and 4 are divided into two chapters each. The first covers the concepts and ideas of that fundamental, and the second gives specific, actionable advice on how to improve that fundamental. For instance, in part 3, Honest Living, Chapter 8 covers the concept of demographics and how it affects how women are going to respond to you. Chapter 9, called How to Be Handsome, then describes how to use the knowledge of demographics to make ourselves as attractive as possible to each woman we meet. Part 5 is 4 chapters to cover all aspects of communicating efficiently, verbally, physically, etc. And keep in mind, moving forward, that the foundation behind all of the advice given is the idea that an honest expression of yourself and your desires as a man is the most effective way to demonstrate non-neediness and to therefore create lasting and genuine attraction with women who will make you the happiest. If at any point along the first 7 chapters you felt like something didn't make sense or didn't click, then you may want to flip back and review it. If not, if everything makes sense and the reasoning behind everything I've said so far makes sense, then you're ready. Read on. Part 3, Honest Living. Chapter 8, Demographics. Before we get into what to say to women, how to make them laugh, how to talk to them, where to take them, how to kiss them, before we even get into the basic questions like what to wear or how to look, what to say first, we have to ask a more important question, a question whose answer will affect and change everything listed above. Which women do you want to meet? Context. You can meet women in coffee shops, but whether there are cold approaches, business networking events, or a speed dating event is going to make a huge difference. This question of where and in what context you meet women is what I call demographics, and it is by and large ignored by pretty much all dating advice out there today. This absolutely boggles my mind, since social interactions are always contextual, and therefore picking up women is always contextual. The fact is that some books tell a 40-year-old divorced banker meeting women at an art gallery the same thing that they tell a 19-year-old college kid who sneaks into house parties. This is stupid. These two guys have completely different priorities, life experiences, personalities, interests, and the women they're going to meet in those two locations are going to be different in age, education, values, emotional development, appearance, and interests. That some books would give these men the exact same lines or strategies to use just goes to show how completely out of tune a lot of men's dating advice and pickup theory is today. In fact, time has shown that great swaths of men have become disgruntled and repeatedly unsuccessful with a lot of this advice, and I think most of this vast lack of success can be attributed to ignoring demographics. The theory of demographics is simple and easy to remember. Like attracts like. If you're a successful professional who likes fine wine, studied abroad, and dresses well, chances are the type of women you're going to naturally meet and attract in your everyday life are going to be similarly educated, similar-looking women with similar interests and similar success. When demographics don't match up, it causes friction. And as we learned in Chapter 4, friction prevents attraction from turning into hooking up. A very common demographic mismatch scenario is the bookworm who takes up pickup lines and tactics. Let's say we have a 35-year-old engineer named John. John has been a bookworm and shut-in all his life. He's had 2 serious girlfriends, both lasting more than 5 years apiece. He's recently single and has decided that he wants to date and meet as many women as possible before he decides to get married. So John reads some pickup material and begins hitting nightclubs with it. Now let's ignore the lines he uses for a moment. In fact, let's assume that the lines he uses are very good, even though they're probably not. He approaches a very hot blonde girl named Jenna. Jenna is 20 years old and in her second year at community college. She comes from a worse part of town and has been working a retail job at a shoe store for the last 5 years to put herself through community college, although she doesn't like anything she's learning. Her only relief is when she gets to go party at the club each weekend, where all of her friends are, and where she gets to relish in the really hot guys hitting on her and buying her drinks. John has 3 degrees, has spent the last 8 years working 60 hours a week, and he never drinks. He's maybe been to 20 parties in his entire life, and has only been drunk twice. He's passive and analytical, and his sense of humor is highly intellectual. He's soft-spoken and thoughtful. He's not dressed entirely well, and his hair is unkempt. He wears big glasses and is slightly shorter than average. It's not hard to see that when he approaches Jenna, no matter what he says or what line he uses, it's going to end very quickly, and chances are Jenna's not going to be subtle about her lack of interest. John may come away blaming the lines he's used for not working, or he may blame himself for being ugly or being a little short. But let's keep the thought experiment going. Let's say 2 years go by. In those 2 years, John works on himself. He dresses impeccably now. He wears custom-tailored designer clothing that is not only stylish but reflects his successful business persona. He's groomed and styled very well. He's gone to the gym and buffed up, gotten contacts instead of his glasses, and paid a hairstylist to fix up his hair. John's also discovered the fun of partying. He enjoys going out with some of his new young professional friends to drink and dance and have fun. He's begun spending more time at the beach and has been teaching himself guitar on and off. He's gotten laid a few times and realized that attractive women aren't such a big deal to get worked up about. Jenna has also changed in the past 2 years. Since she last met John, she's dedicated herself to her studies. She just got into nursing school and has been taking it seriously and realizes that she's much smarter than she thought she was, and that at times, she actually enjoys learning. She also got out of a one-year relationship with a football player who treated her like crap. She's realized that she needs a guy who's more responsible than she is. This time, when John approaches her, lines or not, they suddenly have an overlapping demographic. John is now an attractive, well-kept, successful bachelor who knows how to let loose, have fun, and express his emotions. Jenna is now not only beautiful, but also responsible, ambitious, and confident. Now, it's true that if John practiced and perfected his use of lines and tactics, he may be able to convince Jenna in the short term that he's less invested and is actually in her demographic. You know, vague stories about stripper ex-girlfriends and the like. But hopefully by now you realize how badly these kinds of strategies backfire, particularly in the long run. Eventually, John's lines will run out, and like Cinderella after the ball, Jenna will be horrified at who she's actually talking to. But because John and Jenna both worked on themselves, broadened their demographics, enriched their lifestyles, and lived their lives how they wanted even more, they came to find enough overlap and commonality to be attracted to one another. This is the power of demographics. A demographic mismatch can be seen in terms of friction. If she loves to ski and ride horses, and you hate the outdoors and traveling, then that's going to cause friction. Perhaps not immediately, but at some point. If she values having fun, expressing her emotions openly, and what her friends think of her, and you value serious conversation, intellectual pursuits, and don't care much for social gatherings, there's going to be a large amount of friction from the get-go. This is unavoidable. Pickup lines don't change it. Being good-looking doesn't change it. Being rich won't change it. If you hate what she loves and she hates what you love, it's not going anywhere. Period. If she dedicates a lot of time and effort to her appearance and enjoys getting attention from good-looking guys, and you don't shower, dress poorly, and haven't ever seen the inside of a gym, then there's going to be a large amount of friction. These are cold, hard facts. Nobody probably tells you this, but it's obvious and it's true. Sorry. The examples are endless, but this explains why sometimes you meet women you just click with, and more often than not, you meet these women in situations that you're having fun and doing what you love. Subsection. Lifestyle choices and demographics. The theory of demographics has advantages as well. If you play to your strengths, i.e., you focus your time and energy on meeting women in situations who are likely to share your values, interests, and needs, then you're going to not only experience a much higher degree of success, but you're going to meet women you enjoy a lot more. For instance, I love to travel. I love meeting women who love to travel. It's my absolutely favorite thing to talk about, and typically, if I find a well-traveled woman, I find it very easy to pick her up and date her. When I'm at a random bar in Texas, I rarely meet women who have traveled. But when I go to a European wine tasting in New York, I almost meet nothing but women who love to travel. Or even better, if I actually get up and go to another country and meet other people traveling in that country, I'm going to have an extremely high hit rate with those women. If you love dancing or different types of music, then chances are the women that you're going to meet at various dance events and concerts are going to be more compatible with you and you're going to have much more success with them. This seems like obvious advice, but it blows my mind how most guys never even consider it, and most dating advice completely ignores it. Bars and nightclubs are generally considered quote-unquote meat markets, or the obvious places everyone goes to meet somebody. But think about the people and context in which you're walking into in a bar or nightclub, a high-energy, generic party situation, where people value having fun and spending time with their friends. Assuming you're a guy who loves to party, have fun, and hang out with a bunch of new friends, that's great. But if you're not that naturally outgoing social type, then chances are you're not going to be very compatible with most of the people there. It isn't until you develop that aspect of your personality or lifestyle that those women will begin to open up to you. I'm not saying that you should never go to bars or clubs. In fact, their benefits will be discussed in part 4. But the point I'm making is that you should pay attention to where you're meeting women and the type of women that you meet. If you're a 49-year-old software consultant, overweight, and enjoy reading poetry in your free time, chances are you're going to have very little to talk to nothing to talk about or offer to a 20-year-old go-go dancer, high school dropout down at Lust Thursdays, other than your appreciation for her tight ass and her appreciation for your wallet. What I recommend to every guy before he even thinks about talking to women is to sit down for a while and ask himself some questions. What do you value in a woman? Honesty, affection, intelligence, curiosity, similar interests, education. Women with traits that you value, where do they frequent? Where are you most likely to find them? What do you enjoy doing most? Do you love to read and write? Do you love to play music? Do you enjoy sports and competition? What are events or organizations that you can become involved with to explore your hobbies? If you don't know what your passions and interests are, take a minute and write down things that you've always wanted to do but never had the time or never worked up the nerve to do them. Make a promise to yourself to get involved in that activity or event in some way. Obviously, not every interest is going to be overflowing with women. If you're a competitive chess player, chances are you're not going to meet many women at chess tournaments. But few people have only one passion or interest, and chances are that you have at least a few things that you're interested in that are overflowing with women. Here are examples of great hobbies or events that you can use to meet women. Dance classes, such as salsa, swing, ballroom. Political organizations or events. Concerts or concert promotions. Amateur sports leagues. Ultimate frisbee and co-ed volleyball tend to have a lot of women, in very good shape as well. Volunteering, charities, charity events. These are usually overloaded with women. Training courses and leadership or public speaking. Cooking classes. Yoga classes, which is a gold mine. Meditation courses and retreats, self-help seminars, educational events, travel groups. For the religious, a church or whatever your faith equivalent is. Educational classes, foreign language, CPA, etc. Also, meetup.com and livingsocial.com are excellent resources for finding like-minded people and cool events going on in your city. I have a friend over 40 who regularly dates women 15 to 20 years younger than him. He's an excellent dancer and goes to the local dance events in his area every week. He's successful, smart, and professional. He's cultured and well-traveled. He also networks through European business people living and working in the U.S. Between these two groups, he meets tons of people and tons of attractive, intelligent women. To kick things off, he often brings them together by hosting events at his house. His huge success, for a man his age, comes not just from his charisma and his game, but from the fact that he's narrowed down the demographic of women who he likes and who are apt to like him perfectly and is able to act on it. A much simpler example is another friend I have who is a professional musician. You'd think he'd be getting laid all the time, but he actually spent most of his time in the studio and rehearsal rooms. That's where the real payday was. But when he became single again, he began taking cheap and easy gigs, playing weddings, dive bars, playing in cover bands, etc., and quickly met more women than he knew what to do with. In my own life, I have a strong passion for traveling and culture. Wherever I go, I make a point to join local events and classes where I'll meet other like-minded people who also travel. When I'm in the U.S., I spend my time at venues or events that are full of foreigners. Whenever I'm in the U.S. and I meet a foreign woman, say, from Argentina, and I immediately start telling her about the 3 months I lived in Buenos Aires, in Spanish, it's pretty easy to pick her up, as you can imagine. To some people, this sounds like copping out, or like it's not really learning pickup or game. But here's the thing. That's the kind of woman who's going to make me happy. She's going to have shared experiences and values with me. And our metric for success is maximizing happiness, not racking up the most lays or having the most impressive game, whatever that means. It's easy to get caught up in the unimportant details and men's locker room type boasting, and easy to forget why we're really here. We want to be with women who make us happy. The answer for you is going to be completely different. These are just some successful examples. What's going to work best for you is going to be entirely different, and you're going to have to experiment on your own. Again, demographics should not determine where you go or don't go, but just be aware that it affects every interaction you have with women. If there is too large of a demographic mismatch, then the friction will be incredibly high, and no matter how attractive you are, she's not going to be able to connect with it. Chances are this may explain a fair amount of failure you've had up until this point. If you're interested in spirituality and meditation, pursue it. If you're interested in politics and being active in your community, then pursue it. If you're interested in food from around the world, then pursue it. Take up cooking classes, food tastings, restaurant openings, etc. Subsection: Beliefs and Self-Selection. Lifestyle choices may play an obvious role in the demographic of women we would like to meet. If you like to do yoga, then if you go and do yoga, you'll meet other women who like to do yoga. They'll be likely to be attracted to you, and you'll likely be attracted to them. Duh. But what's not as obvious, but just as important, if not more important, is how our beliefs naturally screen the women who come into our lives. When I say beliefs, I mean beliefs about women, sex, relationships, and ourselves. The idea is that our beliefs are reflected in our behavior, and the behavior determines which and how many women are attracted to us. For instance, if you believe all women are sluts and untrustworthy, then the only women who are going to be willing to tolerate your behavior are promiscuous women who are untrustworthy. Think about it. A genuinely chaste and respectful woman would be far less likely to put up with you not trusting her or her sexuality. Another example is the belief that women want and enjoy sex as much as men do. This belief was a big one for me. Many men don't believe that women actually enjoy or fantasize about sex. So how would this belief affect your behavior and screen the women who are attracted to you? If you believe women don't enjoy sex, then the women who do enjoy sex will most likely not feel comfortable expressing their sexuality around you, and the women who don't enjoy sex will feel like you understand them. Thus, you'll be stuck dating a bunch of women disconnected from their sexuality and uncomfortable having sex. But if you believe that women do enjoy sex, then the women who do enjoy sex will feel comfortable expressing their sexuality around you, while the women who are not comfortable expressing their sexuality will not be comfortable around you. Yes, this will invite rejections, but remember, rejections are a form of screening for demographics, and in this case, it's doing you a big favor. You'll end up with a bunch of sexual and sensual women who enjoy being with you. There's nothing wrong with that. Screening women through your personal beliefs is incredibly powerful. I honestly think that most problems that men turn to tactics and techniques to overcome could easily be solved by simply adopting the appropriate belief or mindset. Unfortunately, beliefs are harder to pinpoint and also harder to implement than simply memorizing some lines or basic rules or techniques, so this approach is not adopted very often. But I think acknowledging your beliefs and also being able to acknowledge that they may not be true comes back to what was discussed in Chapter 4, being able to take an open and honest look at yourself and your desires. Becoming a non-needy man requires first and foremost an honesty with oneself. Part of that honesty with oneself involves observing and challenging your own beliefs. If you've lived your entire life believing women are untrustworthy or that women expressing themselves sexually is immoral, then perhaps you should evaluate what kind of women those beliefs are going to attract into your life. If you don't want to attract those kinds of women, perhaps you should look at changing your beliefs. As a concrete example of how our beliefs lead to our expectations, which leads to our results, let's take a cross-section of a couple typical beliefs that men have about women and see what kind of results we could expect from them. The first belief is the assumption that a woman is attracted to you. There are some men who operate on the assumption that all women are interested in them until proven otherwise. There are other men who operate on the assumption that no women are interested in them until proven otherwise. Obviously, there's no way for any given man to always know which women are interested in him at any given time. Men who overassume attraction from women are obviously going to periodically pursue women who are actually not interested, and men who underassume attraction will periodically let go women who are interested, assuming that they're not. The second belief we'll look at is that women play games or are quote-unquote testing you. A lot has been made about women and their tests and that they put men through, particularly in the pickup artist community. I personally believe that these ideas of tests are blown out of proportion, and as we'll see, women will only toy with your emotions if you expect them to do it or if you let them do it. Men who are paranoid about games and tests end up trying to outgame these women. Sometimes it works, but sometimes it drives away women who are legitimately honest about their interests. Other times, they lose the game and get led on by women who are not interested and end up wasting a bunch of time. Now, let's say you go out and get a bunch of phone numbers over the period of a few months. During this period, you can have some configuration of these two beliefs. What are your results going to look like? We'll start with, let's say you assume attraction and assume women are playing games. If you assume women are attracted to you, then you're rightly going to pursue every woman you have an opportunity with, whether they actually like you or not. But if you believe that most of them are going to manipulate you and play games with you, then you're going to try and play games with them as well, not answering calls, postponing dates, teasing, calling them out for bad behavior, etc. Let's see what kind of results these beliefs will likely bring. Let's begin with women who are attracted to you and are not playing games. They're being upfront and honest about their interest, but because you believe they are playing games, you're going to try to outgame a woman who's not actually playing games with you. This will actually come off as try-hard and high-maintenance, effectively scaring off honest and upfront women from becoming involved with you. Women who are not attracted to you and do not play games will simply flake on you. That's obvious. Women who are not attracted to you but do play games will enter into a game battle with you in which you'll end up losing since they're not actually interested. All they will do is waste your time and confuse you. And finally, women who do like you and do play games will enter into a game battle with you in which you may win or lose. But even if you win, you've now attracted a dramatic and manipulative woman who will lie and use you. And to get there, you dealt with a bunch of dramatic and manipulative women who never had any interest with you. All of the honest and upfront women passed you by, being turned off by your inability to be straightforward with your intentions. Now let's try the two beliefs. You assume they're not attracted, and you assume they don't play games. Suppose you assume most women do not play games, and most women are not attracted to you. Let's see how this plays out with your results. Because you assume most women are not interested in you, you'll spend a lot of time gaming women who actually aren't, converting very few. Women who are not attracted and do not play games will repeatedly reject you. Women who are not attracted but do play games will milk your attention and validation, wasting your time and effort. Conversely, you will turn off a few attracted women by overgaming them. The ones who do not play games will either just drop you for being try-hard, or they will hook up with you anyway, regardless of what you say. Women who do play games will feign disinterest, but because you assume they're not attracted and don't play games, you'll believe them and stop pursuing. So what you'll be left with is a handful of women who are attracted to you anyway, who don't play games, but would have hooked up with you regardless what you said or what you did, but you just made it much, much harder on them. So all your effort to win them over was pointless and actually scared some of them away. Now let's look at it if you assume they have no attraction and you also assume that they play games. Having both of these sets of beliefs will perhaps lead to the saddest results of all. Since you will assume almost no women are attracted to you, you will always overcompensate, scaring away a great many who are actually attracted to you, and rightly recognizing the ones who are not interested. But since you also assume that women play games, you will not trust these women's reactions and waste a lot of time trying to win over women who never liked you in the first place, and scaring off even more women who originally liked you even more. The only women who will put up with you are the women who play games, but because you assume they don't like you, you'll be unlikely to ever pursue the women who are interested in you but also playing games, and you'll fetter away your time and effort with the uninterested women who do play games as well. All in all, you'll expend a massive amount of time and effort trying to win over women who were never interested in you and scaring away the women who were. But because you believe the honest women who genuinely liked you to be A, dishonest, and B, not actually attracted, you'll never act on the correct signals, always deferring back to your games and tricks to try to win them over. Guys with both of these beliefs will often go months or years pursuing women with no results. It's sad to see. Finally, let's look at assume attraction, but you also assume that women don't play games. Let's look at the complete opposite. You believe that most women are inherently attracted to you, but you also believe that most women are honest and upfront about their intentions. First of all, women who are interested in you and honest about it, you'll immediately hook up with them, and it'll be great passionate sex. Women who are not interested in you and upfront about it, you'll immediately move on, wasting no time or energy. Women who are interested in you but play games, you will take them at their word and stop pursuing them. Sometimes this will actually induce women who play games to stop playing games when she realizes that she may lose you. Other times it doesn't. Women who don't like you but play games, you will take them at their word, and when they don't follow through, you'll move on. So what you end up with are women who are attracted to you and who are not afraid to show it. All the women who are afraid to show it, you unconsciously screened and weeded out by simply accepting their actions and behavior at face value. The women who were not attracted or interested in you, you unconsciously screened through by not trying to win them over. All in all, little time, little effort, and lots of honest, genuine women who are attracted to you, appreciate you, and want to have sex with you. Sounds good to me. Subsection: Age, Money, and Looks. The touchiest part of all demographics, and honestly, possibly the touchiest subject of all dating advice, is that of age, money, and looks. I want to get this out of the way and make it 100% clear. Age, money, and looks matter. In some cases a lot, in other cases not a lot, but but they matter, and anyone who tells you that they don't matter is lying. Don't believe the marketing, don't believe the hype. With that said, age, money, and looks don't matter nearly as much as most guys think they do, and if you're aware of the effects of demographics, they aren't that important at all. When it comes to age, studies show that men's physical attractiveness peaks at around 31, a luxury considering that women peak around 21, and that our physical attractiveness recedes far slower than women's do. In fact, studies have found that the average 45-year-old male is considered as physically attractive as the average 18-year-old male. If this sounds preposterous, hear me out for one more paragraph. The main reason is that studies have also found that women judge men far less based on actual physical dimensions and far more on style, grooming, and how they present themselves. As men, we're extremely lucky in this regard. Taking a guy from a baggy t-shirt and ripped jeans to a nice tailored suit with a professional haircut will immediately bump him up 50% in the looks department overnight, whereas women, it's a constant and never-ending battle to maximize their physical appearance as much as possible. How to be as good-looking as possible will be covered in depth in the next chapter, but for now, just know that no matter how ugly you think you are, and chances are, you're not that ugly even if you think you are, there's hope for you, and we'll take care of it soon enough. Money is nice in that it demonstrates success and implies other positive attractive traits, but again, its utility is vastly overblown. When it comes to money, once again, the surveys and studies have some interesting findings. The first is that the importance of money and success matters more depending on your age. The older you are, the more money you're expected to have and more successful you're expected to be in order to be attractive. The other finding is that the less well-off she is, the more important money will be to her. This is why the stereotypical gold digger is usually a very beautiful young woman who grew up in poverty. Women who grow up with money or have money usually don't care about it nearly as much. But the fact remains that women perceive men with money the same way we perceive women with good looks, as social status. How each woman defines social status and whether money is a part of that or not is going to vary. But again, returning to the high-end, trendy nightclub demographic, ask yourself what kind of girl frequents a ridiculously overpriced nightclub so that she can hang out with C-list celebrities every week and have random guys ogle her and buy her drinks. A girl seeking a lot of social status, and for these girls, money matters, success matters, but most of all, attractive behavior matters. Which brings me to my primary point when it comes to age, money, and looks. Again, it's about demographics. Ask yourself which demographic of women are looks or money highly important for. Women who tend to value only good looks tend to be women who only have good looks, and women who are highly interested in money are going to be women who don't have other interests or other things going for them. What I'm saying is, women who only care about these things, such as looks or money, are usually only going to be the women who are not going to be interested in you or who are going to make you happy. With that said, everybody values looks and success to some extent, so it's not something we can write off completely. You should be as good looking as you possibly can be, and you should be as financially successful as you can possibly be. And even the most interesting and well-rounded and psychologically healthy women are still going to prefer a good-looking and successful man to one who isn't. So yes, looks and money matter. So the question is, how do they affect our results with the majority of women? It's simple. Money, looks, and success are all indicators of status. Women are attracted to status. Behavior is also an indicator of status. So the more money, looks, and success you have, the less attractive behavior you need. The less money, looks, or status you have, the more attractive behavior you need. Again, this kind of comes back to the concept of game. The idea of game is the idea that you can pick up any girl simply by your behavior, not by using social connections, wealth, or good looks. So if you're short or older or not that good looking, you can still theoretically attract any woman you want. It's just going to take more attractive behavior. Another way to think of this is that age, money, and looks are all universal demographics, and therefore lacking in any one of them is apt to cause extra friction everywhere. But just because there's friction, or just because there are less receptive women, is no excuse for not having success in the long run. The vast majority of guys who get hung up on looks and money get hung up on them because they're using it as an excuse. It's absolutely not an excuse. A guy who is good looking or rich still has to work for his results. He just doesn't have to work as hard. Trust me, I've coached dozens of guys who are far more professionally successful than me and far more good looking than me, yet I still get with more girls and hotter girls than they do. Being good looking and being rich is worth nothing if you don't do something with it. You can be the richest guy in the world, but if you behave like a timid and weak chump, then girls will be repelled. Well, at least the girls worth having will be repelled. And as we'll discuss in the next chapter, anyone can be handsome and look high status if they put enough effort into it. So there's no excuses, fellas. And of course, status is ultimately determined by demographics. At a college house party, a burly 20-year-old kid who crushes beer cans on his head is going to have a high level of status to girls there. At an opening at a local art gallery, he's going to have almost none. A skinny bass player hipster is going to have a lot of status at a local indie show and low status at a business networking event. A successful stock trader who wears Armani suits is going to have high status at his firm's annual Christmas party and very little status at a hippie music festival. It's all relative. The key is to 1, recognize your personal interests and strengths, 2, play up those personal interests and strengths, and 3, hone in on your target demographic. Subsection, race and the foreigner effect. It's worth taking a moment to mention race and its effect on attraction and dating. A lot of foreign men of different ethnicities have a lot of insecurities or false beliefs about their race and their ability to date women of other races. Many Indian and Asian men feel like white women would never be attracted to them. A lot of black men run into threatened responses from white and Asian women. There are 2 considerations to take about race. The first is that race naturally polarizes your responses. In a way, this is good, but it's also going to be a little bit more of a painful experience. So for instance, if you're a white guy, then most women will be pretty neutral towards your race. This allows you a greater overall opportunities, but they're all opportunities that you'll still have to work for. You're going to be hard-pressed to find a woman who says to herself, "Oh my God, I can't believe I'm meeting a white guy." The exception is, of course, if you live in a foreign country where white people are minorities, such as Japan or Korea. But if you're Asian, African, Middle Eastern, or Latino, then approaching women is going to sometimes elicit a small polarization. Some women are going to immediately be more intrigued and interested in you, and other women are going to be more shut off from meeting you. In my experience in the Western world, Asian and Indian men run into the smallest amounts of polarization. Latin and Middle Eastern men run into a modest amount, and black men will run into a significant amount of polarization. There are some women of all races out there who absolutely love black men. A lot of women fantasize about black men and wonder what it'd be like to be with one. And there are others who are not interested in black men at all. But if you are a black man, you need to be prepared for this dichotomy of responses. You'll get some very harsh rejections, rejections that your white and Asian friends will not experience as often. At the same time, you'll meet women who will often want to have sex with you pretty much immediately. And as you probably know, there's a saying among women, once you go black, you never go back. Also, typically, if you're a minority, then women of your own ethnicity will be polarized towards you. So for instance, if you're an Asian man, then Asian women are going to most likely respond the most warmly to you and more warmly than they would to a white guy or a Latin guy. If you're a Latino, then Latin women will respond to you most warmly towards you, and so on. The reason for this is not only because of cultural similarities, such as both you and her probably grew up in Latin households, but also because humans are hardwired to be attracted to members of the opposite sex who have similar physical traits as themselves. This isn't always the case, but people generally feel more comfortable around people who are similar to them. The second effect of being a minority or hitting on women of a different race is that you have to face racial stereotypes. This is an unfortunate but true part of our world. People make racial stereotypes about each other, whether they realize it consciously or not. I didn't truly understand this until I began to travel widely, and I met women in countries where white men had certain stereotypes that I had to deal with repeatedly. I'd like to make it very clear so that I don't offend anybody in the next section. The racial stereotypes I mentioned below are not my personal beliefs, and they're not necessarily true. They're simply what I've observed working and speaking with many men of minority races in the Western world. So don't take this as gospel, but merely an observation. Unfortunately, as much as we'd like to pretend we don't live in a racist world, we do. And so while you will meet many, many women who don't care what your race is, you will meet some who will care, and you'll meet a few who may have ignorant beliefs about your ethnicity. So again, what I'm going to list here isn't necessarily my own beliefs. It's just what I've found that men with minorities have to deal with. So if it makes you mad, then be mad at how ignorant most people are. Don't shoot the messenger. In general, in Western culture, the stereotype of Asian or Indian men is that they're hardworking and smart, but traditional, very analytical, and emotionally shut down. The stereotype of Latin men is that they're romantic and emotional, but also selfish and unfaithful. The stereotype of Middle Eastern men is that they are controlling and somewhat misogynistic. The stereotype of Black men is that they're very aggressive and sometimes disrespectful. I didn't invent these stereotypes. I don't even believe them. But they are simply what I've observed over my years and years of going out with men and speaking to them about their experiences. But racial stereotypes can be used to your advantage. What I've found, and what many minority men have found, is that if you can calibrate your behavior to contrast your racial stereotype, you'll actually create a lot of intrigue and attraction. So for instance, if you're an Asian man, making an effort to be even more playful and energetic and aggressive will actually net you in even more positive reactions than a white guy behaving the same way. If you're a Black man, behaving in a sensitive and understanding way will often net you more positive responses than if a white guy does it. The reason this works is because you're going against a racial stereotype. Consciously or not, many women will see an Asian guy approach her and automatically assume that he's going to be a boring engineer or something. But if he turns out to be the most engaging and exciting man that they've met that night, it creates a high level of intrigue. Your simple presence and behavior challenges their conceptions of what Asian men are like and therefore makes you incredibly unique right off the bat. Of course, you will meet many, many, many women in the Western world who don't care at all what race you are. In fact, I would say most women don't care what race you are. But unfortunately, there are differences, and so I felt like they needed to be addressed. The other point of interest is the foreigner effect. Once again, being a foreigner in another country is going to polarize you with most women. In the long run, this is a good thing, and one reason why I enjoy living abroad so much. But it does mean you're going to have to face a lot more rejection than you would back in your home country. The degree that you polarize will depend on the country and where you're from, as well as the stereotypes your nationality carries with it. Subsection: Social Proof. One of the more popular concepts in the pickup artist theory introduced into the dating world was the concept of social proof and how it affects social status. If you remember from Chapter 1, women are biologically wired to seek out the highest status male possible. Even though this concept of status is murky and not always clear, women have unconscious ways of sensing a high status male. The concept of social proof comes from influence psychology and is the idea that as humans, when we see many other people valuing something, we will unconsciously value it ourselves. For instance, if everybody else is talking about a new movie, we are likely to want to see it because we'll unconsciously assume that it's good and an important movie to see. This works with people as well. If you're at a party and somebody walks in and everybody in the party stops what they're doing to turn and say hello to that person, your first thought would probably be, "Wow, who is that guy?" Chances are you'd want to meet him as well. The idea is that this applies to women in attraction. If you are a man who walks into a room and everybody stops what they're doing to talk to you, then women in the room are more likely to perceive you as high status and be attracted to you. This is why men in power, celebrities, athletes, etc., are desired by so many women. Despite a lot of shoddy application and theorizing by the pickup artists, this concept and its effect on attraction holds true. The goal as a man is to cultivate as much social status within your demographic as possible. So for instance, if you're a high-powered executive at your firm, then you have a large degree of social status and social proof at work. But chances are the women who work with you are going to have some degree of attraction for you. But if you go to a nightclub on the weekend and you know nobody there, then your social status is back to square one, and you're just another guy. That's why once you narrow down your demographic, you want to cultivate your connections and put yourself into as big of a leadership position as possible. Don't just join the intramural frisbee team, start organizing it. Don't just volunteer at a charity event, help find sponsors for it. Don't just hang out at a local nightclub, but become a promoter for it. Part of living an honest lifestyle is to pursue what you're passionate about to the fullest extent. If you absolutely love visiting art exhibitions, don't just visit a bunch of art exhibitions. Take an active role in the organization. Start a meetup group to find other people who want to visit them. Create a forum for commentary. Don't just pursue your interests. Become a leader in your interests. Don't just choose a demographic of women to meet, but dominate that demographic. Hopefully by now you're getting a clearer idea of what demographic of women you're currently attracting and which demographic of women that you would like to attract. In the next chapter, we'll get into specifics on how to pursue the correct demographic for you and how to become as attractive as you possibly can be. But first, I want to address a very popular concern of single men, and a question I've gotten constantly over the last 5 years, and that's the demographic of extremely beautiful women. Subsection: The Most Beautiful Women. In this section, I will address the differences in one specific demographic, the most beautiful women. Let's arbitrarily say that this section applies to the top 1% of women in terms of physical appearance, and from here on refer to these women in general as the top 1%. Being the top 1% in physical appearance means that more or less 99% of the male population is going to be interested and/or pursuing them in some way. This is a major difference from just about any other woman out there. Even very attractive women may only have 70 or 80% of the men that they meet pursuing or interested in them. But as a top 1% woman, for all intents and purposes, just about every single man she ever meets is going to be very sexually interested in her. Obviously, this is going to have a significant effect on not only her psychology, but on the types of men that she's going to be attracted to. There are two primary differences when dealing with the top 1% demographic. First is that the most beautiful women rarely ever settle for a man who's not a total package, or a man who does not have all the three fundamentals handled. The second difference is that extremely beautiful women are far less needy than the average woman, and therefore they're going to be extremely attuned and sensitive to any neediness in men. Ironically, the fact that these women are so beautiful often causes men to become even more needy than usual, and as we learned in part one, her being less invested than normal, while being surrounded by men who are more invested than normal, is a recipe for her being attracted to very, very few men. But let's start with the first difference. The fact that the top 1% rarely ever settle for a man with a major flaw. And by flaw, I don't mean character flaw, as we all have those, but I mean a man who exhibits a large amount of neediness anywhere in his life. If there's one thing that's true about the top 1%, it's that they have a much larger selection of suitors at any given time than the average girl. They meet rich guys all the time. They meet musicians and actors and DJs and guys with big muscles and guys with nice cars. It's not that you need any of this stuff, although it may help, but you cannot have a glaring hole in your lifestyle. You need to have your lifestyle together. A nice job that you like, a nice place that you like, nice friends that you like, cool hobbies you like, good health, good shape, and generally a well-adjusted and confident person. Picking up most girls, you can get away without one or a few of those in that list, but the top 1%, you need to have them all handled. You need to be a complete package. Look at it from her perspective. The first way she screens men is by confidence and charm. Let's say she meets 20 men 1 week and 3 of them are confident and not needy and charming and she likes being around them. The first one is very good looking, but he's also unemployed and living with a family friend. He has no car, and the second has his life together and is pretty wealthy but is overweight and dresses very poorly. The third guy has his life together and is in great shape and takes care of himself. All else being equal, she's going to go with the third. It's not that looks are all that matter, but when she has so many options, she has no reason to ever settle. That's why you need to be the complete package. You don't have to look like Brad Pitt or be a millionaire or be a world-class athlete or something. You really just can't have a major hole in your lifestyle. Treat this as kind of a prerequisite. The second major difference is more difficult to handle. The fact that more beautiful women are less needy on average than men makes them more difficult than the average woman. But paradoxically, if you try harder to get with more beautiful women, then you'll just demonstrate yourself to be even more needy than you were before. It's back to the old try to look like you're not trying conundrum. The answer is to stop caring about how beautiful they are. This sounds totally counterintuitive at first, but it's true. Top 1% women are treated differently their entire lives by men. These men project their fears and fantasies onto these women, and when they approach them, they're doing it for their own self-esteem and validation, not because they actually care what the girls like or interested in. Do not be this guy. The fact that you even ask this question means that you're guilty of this, and I was guilty of this too. The first step to doing this is to ditch any sort of rating scale for women. Again, I was guilty of this for a long time, but the rating scale is toxic in so many ways, the worst of which is that it subtly stereotypes behavior based on appearance. So the fact that you even recognize in your mind that approaching a 10 is different than a 7 is immediately going to affect your behavior towards her. A rating scale is a subtle and unconscious way of putting women on a pedestal and therefore highly investing yourself for superficial reasons and making yourself more needy. This leads to unattractive intentions, which will permeate all of your behavior. Top 1% of women will sense this immediately because top 1% of women have been dealing with needy men their entire lives. They can smell it a mile away. The other problem with treating women differently based on ratings is simply that it doesn't work. You'll meet tens who think that they're fives and fives who think they're tens, not to mention that your six could be my eight and my five could be your nine. At the end of the day, her behavior is more determined on how she sees herself more than how others see her, so it's pointless. When you approach, she's just another woman. You really have to stop caring. I used to get so obsessed about finding high-quality girls, and I just let it go a little more than a year ago. It's no coincidence that I pick up the hottest girls in my life now with the least amount of effort than ever before. A lot of guys have a hard time swallowing this. They want the hottest women because they're the hottest after all. So if you stop wanting them, won't you stop getting them? Not necessarily. It's okay to recognize a woman's beauty and to be turned on by that beauty. But it's not okay to invest one's identity in attaining or conquering that beauty, because that leads to neediness. A beautiful woman will not necessarily make you happier than a less beautiful woman. Any sort of drive or need to have sex with the most beautiful woman for the sake of sex with beautiful women and not for the sake of seeking joy, love, and connection is a purely selfish endeavor. There's nothing high value about a really hot girl. It's just that guys project their insecurities onto these women and think that there's something valuable about them. If you ask these women themselves, they have no perception of this value or this status of which you speak of. None at all. These are just merit badges in your head, constructed as a sad way to validate yourself. I've been with six models, two of which were runway models, a professional dancer, a cheerleader, and a successful stage actress. I've been on dates with girls who have been approached 3 to 5 times while on the date with me. I've dated a girl who dated an NBA basketball player before me. I dated girls who guys I didn't even know came up to me and gave me high fives while she wasn't looking. I never, ever, ever heard one of these girls speak of men in terms of not being cool enough or not being rich enough or not being good looking enough to hang out with them. In fact, I never heard any of them say anything derogatory about men hitting on them except for a man's lack of confidence, a lack of respect, or a lack of authenticity. A typical complaint from a normal girl would be, "He's really nice. Why doesn't he ask me out, though?" A typical complaint from a very hot girl would be, "Ugh, that club promoter keeps flashing his watch at me. He's so sleazy." People really don't get it. These girls don't have it that great. Imagine wanting to date a really great guy, someone who actually cares about you, and literally every single guy you meet starts acting like a total idiot trying to impress you or manipulate you. Meanwhile, your friends who aren't as pretty as you seem to keep meeting really nice, normal guys who actually care about them. It's actually very frustrating. Imagine having everyone evaluate you for how pretty you are and not your personality or what you say. You'd actually be pretty insecure about what people thought of you. This is also why the best way to net a top 1% girl is to connect with her genuinely and emotionally as soon as possible. Find something that you like about her, other than her looks, and relate that to her honestly. Or as the old saying goes, tell the beautiful girls that they're smart, and tell the smart girls that they're beautiful. Guys always assume the hotter the girl, the harder she is to get. I suppose on a purely supply-demand level, that's true. There are fewer hotter girls and more guys trying to get them, but they're really no different. The only thing that's different is that unlike an average pretty girl who only has 50% of guys she meets put her on a pedestal, the super hot girl has 99% of men she meets put her on her pedestal. And so she's going to see through the bullshit immediately. And in case you didn't catch it, the rating scale is a pedestal. The concept of high value is a pedestal. Coming up with special openers is a pedestal. Most pickup artist theory is a pedestal. Believing you have to treat her differently in any way because of how she looks is a pedestal. I recommend guys switch to a binary system of 1 or 0. A 1 is a woman you'd like to be with. A 0 is a woman that you wouldn't. Why you want to be with her or not, how she looks, whether she's just okay looking or the most beautiful woman on the planet, none of that matters. Either you're interested or not. The rest doesn't matter. And in the meantime, get your life together. Stop caring about looks so much. Treat her like you'd treat anybody else. Stop approaching her to prove something to yourself. Stop treating her like a trophy or an achievement or a merit badge. And just talk to her. Just the fact that you talk to her like a normal human being with confidence and civility will immediately differentiate you from 99% of the other guys she meets. Subsection. Being something versus saying something. If there's one takeaway from this chapter, it's that it's far more powerful to be something attractive rather than to say something attractive. You can say the most attractive sentence in the world, but if it isn't backed up by who you are, then it's not going to have any meaning. Whereas if you are something amazing, then no matter what you say will be attractive, because it will be coming from a genuinely attractive man. For instance, imagine you meet two different men. One of them is a scrubby, ugly, and shady character. He can't look you in the eye. He smells bad. He mumbles to himself and scratches himself in inappropriate places. While you're talking to him, he looks at you and says, "You know, I get a good feeling from you. You're someone worth knowing." How would that make you feel? You'd probably get the creeps and want to get away from him as quickly as you could. Now imagine you're talking to a handsome, successful man who is charismatic and charming. Everything he says is fascinating and interesting. Then he looks you in the eye and says, "You know, I get a good feeling from you. You're someone worth knowing." How would that make you feel? It'd make your day. Why? Because the second man is someone. He's not just saying something interesting and charming, but he is interesting and charming. Suddenly the words that come out of his mouth have a whole new weight and meaning. This is why learning pickup techniques and tactics without the fundamental base of a strong lifestyle and identity is more or less useless. Guys can go out and use these lines as much as they want, for weeks, months, or even years, and they'll never get good results because they're not portraying themselves well. They don't have a clear and successful identity. They aren't in touch with the way in which they're living their lives. Because here's the real takeaway from this chapter. Your life and everything that it encompasses is a reflection of your emotional investment in yourself. And the more invested you are in yourself, the less needy you are to others. Men who are more heavily invested in others rather than themselves will float through life doing what others direct them to do. They will wear whatever seems okay. They'll groom themselves to the bare minimum. They'll get a normal job and go to a normal school just because that's what normal people do. They never bothered to strive to do something unique or original or transcendent because that would mean risking not being accepted by others. And as a result, these men present themselves poorly. They're highly invested, needy individuals, and this is immediately apparent in their appearance and lifestyle. They dress normally or poorly. They look normal, say normal things, go to a normal job, and live in a normal place. What does this say about how they feel about themselves? That they feel that they're normal, and that they fight every day of their life to maintain that status quo. What does that subcommunicate about their value to women? That they don't have any. Being sexual and being attractive, by its very nature, is controversial. You must be willing to do something that is going to make you stand out. You're going to have to be willing to risk people not liking you. You have to be willing to sacrifice some people's approval in order to live a life on your own terms. You have to be willing to polarize people's opinion of you. The less polarizing you are, the less attractive you are. And if you live an unpolarizing life, then you're not going to be attractive or unattractive. You're just going to be boring. More of the same, dime a dozen. Hopefully this chapter has helped you question what you're doing with your life, what your identity is, and what you want out of your relationships and what kind of women you'd like to meet. The next chapter is going to get into the specifics on how to portray yourself in a more polarizing manner. It's not portraying yourself in an outlandish manner, although that can work. It's portraying yourself in a way that stands out. It's how to be handsome. Chapter 9, How to Be Handsome. As men, we're prone to assume that women perceive attraction in the same way that we do. Science and psychology show that this isn't true. As men, we judge female beauty mostly on physical aspects: cheekbones, facial symmetry, hip-to-waist ratio, breast size, etc. As such, we often fall into the mistake that women judge our attractiveness by the same metrics, hence obsessions with bench presses, height, and penis pills. Yes, physical measurements play a role in how a man's appearance is judged, but research shows that other factors are far more important. That's why I draw the distinction between being good-looking and being handsome. Not everybody is born good-looking, but any man with some time and effort can become handsome. And in the end, what women want is a man who is handsome. For some reason, many men seem to have this notion that their physical appearance is set in stone and they rarely have any interest in altering it or making any major changes. Indeed, for a lot of men, they read about this stuff, buy a new shirt that's slightly brighter color, get a new watch, and consider these dramatic changes to their appearance. Well, here's a couple of unfortunate truths. The first is that appearance is extremely important. The difference between being perceived as handsome and not handsome is night and day. Yes, you can still be bad looking and get girls, but the difference is in the effort reward ratio is massive. A makeover and wardrobe change can make meeting and dating women 3 times easier literally overnight, not to mention all the psychological side benefits of making you feel more confident, more interesting, more excited, etc. It really blows me away how little attention or care a lot of men put into their appearance. And often these are the same men who come to me and complain that they're just too ugly, short, old, Asian, or whatever, and that women are never going to like them. That's not true. Remember, your outward appearance is a reflection of your self-investment, or the lack thereof. And your level of self-investment will make you less needy towards others, therefore making you more attractive. If you don't put a lot of time and effort into how you look and how you present yourself to the world, women look at that and make unconscious assumptions about your status as a man. The first and obvious step involves grooming and general maintenance. That means regular showering, shaving, and haircuts, wearing deodorant, brushing and flossing your teeth, keeping clean fingernails, and wearing clean clothes. I should not have to be telling you this stuff, but just in case I do, there it is. The above paragraph is non-negotiable, starting today. Now let's move on to the biggest factors on your passive attraction and appearance. The two F's, fashion and fitness. If these two F's don't excite you, or if your immediate thought is, oh, I'll skip this and go straight to the pickup lines,